Wishing you a very pleasant good afternoon, wherever you may be.
Omaha! Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier!
This is what's great about sports. This is what the greatest thing about sports is. You play to win the game. Hello?
Cincinnati.
5 seconds left in the game. Do you believe in miracles? Yes!
Spanning the globe to bring you the constant variety of sport.
Good afternoon, Southeastern. It is a beautiful Wednesday afternoon, January 23rd. This January seems like it's going by a lot faster than last January did. But beside me is my co-host for the day, Sean McKinney, our NBA, what do we call it? NBA insider, NBA.
Insider might be a little insider. Generous, but I'll take it.
But now he's going to turn into the Patriots extraordinaire today as we talk about the two NFC and AFC championship games that went on. I am always, as always, your host, Peter DeFee. This is Sports Access. We do have a little bit of baseball to talk about, as yesterday, the inductees for the 2019 Hall of Fame class were announced. Mariano Rivera, Mike Mussina, Edgar Martinez, and the late, great Roy Halladay will be all joining Lee Smith and Harold Baines, who were also selected earlier or later last year, late last year, by the Game Era Committee. Rivera is the first ever unanimous Hall of Famer. He received all 100 votes. A lot of people were thinking that he wouldn't receive all 100 votes because people knew that he was going to get in first ballot, so they probably would have used their votes for somebody else. But he gets all 100 votes. 652 career saves, most in MLB history. 50 or more games saved twice. 40 or more games saved nine times. His 42 saves and a .7 ERA are both the best in MLB postseason history. And he did this with all probably the best pitch in his cutter that he used predominantly through his whole career. Spent all seasons with the New York Yankees. Won five titles, including the 99 World Series MVP. Also won the 2003 ALCS MVP. Just an all-around dominant player. Some cool stats on that real quick before I move on to the other guys. More people have walked on the moon 12. There's been 12 people that have walked on the moon and only 11 have walked against Mariano Rivera. So more people have walked on the moon than Mariano Rivera has walked in the postseason.
What?
Yeah.
Are you making that up?
No. That's a pretty cool stat.
Wow.
Also, he's a 13-time All-Star in 19 seasons. He finished for a career with a 2.21 ERA for his regular season. Like I said, he was one of the best postseason pitchers ever. 42 postseason saves is the most. The next is Brad Lidge with 24, and he's been out of the league since 2010. So, one of the greatest pitchers ever. Gets 100% of the votes, as he should have. Next is Mike Mussina. This is a little bit of a surprising one. A lot of people didn't think he was a Hall of Famer, even though he won 270 games, but didn't win a Cy Young, didn't win any of the big name things, didn't throw a no-hitter. You know, it was just one of those pitchers that just went out there every fifth day, gave him the ball, and just went out there and performed. He was a five-time All-Star, seven-time Gold Glove winner. Like I said, he never won a Cy Young, was in the top five in voting, though, however, six times. With the Orioles and the Yankees, he went 270, 153, had a 3.68 ERA with 2,813 strikeouts. So very deserving for him. I know the Yankees fan base was very happy for him to be going into the Hall of Fame as he helped them out a little bit with his tenure there. Edgar Martinez, who I thought should have been a Hall of Famer 5 years ago, finally gets on the ballot, or finally gets in the Hall of Fame, finally gets the 75% votes that he needed to get into the Hall of Fame, but he was kind of left off because he was a DH. He's a seven-time All-Star, five-time Silver Slugger Award winner, won the batting title twice as a third baseman in DH, was predominantly a DH, though, however, later in his career with the Seattle Mariners, but he was a .312 hitter with 309 home runs, 1,261 RBIs, and an OPS of 933 for his career, which is really good. But I thought he should have been a Hall of Famer way before that, but finally gets the recognition that he deserves on that part. Last but certainly not least is the late, great Roy Halladay, eight-time All-Star, two-time Cy Young Award winner, one of the only Cy Young Award winners to win it both in the AL and the NL with Toronto and Philadelphia. Considered probably one of the most dominating starters in his era, like I said, with both the Blue Jays and the Phillies. Started his career with the Blue Jays, kind of resurrected it with the Phillies in 2010 when he came over. But he ended his career with a 203-105 mark, a 3.38 ERA, and 2,117 strikeouts on his career. In 2010, which was cool, he threw both a perfect game and a no-hitter, a perfect game against the Florida Marlins in May of the regular season, and then was one of two pitchers to throw a no-hitter in the postseason, next to Don Larsen, who, if you guys remember, probably not because not a lot of people were born. 1955, he threw a perfect game against the Dodgers in the World Series. Only perfect game ever thrown in the World Series, but now they have another postseason no-hitter with Roy Halladay. That was his first career start, however, too, against the Cincinnati Reds in 2010. But tragically, in November 2007, he died in an airplane crash. So what his wife said about him receiving the Hall of Fame nod was something really special. And I'm sure, Sean, I'm sure you didn't really see like the videos of them going to the Hall of Fame, but Mariano Rivera, his family, you know, were kind of like, all right, yeah, you made it to the Hall of Fame. But as soon as the guy that called Mariano Rivera said, you are the first person, they all went screaming because they knew he was going to say the first person to be unanimously voted.
Wow.
So that's pretty cool. But just to think of it, you have guys like Hank Aaron, who broke the home run record, Babe Ruth, who was the first ever inductee into the Hall of Fame, didn't even get 100% of the votes. Jimmy Fox, Ty Cobb, Ken Griffey Jr., guys like that, Nolan Ryan, nobody's gotten 100% of the votes, but finally Mariano Rivera has gotten the 100% of the votes, which leads to question is, will Derek Jeter get 100% of the votes? He's on the ballot this coming year, so it'll be interesting to see what they get, because they were going to be in a little bit of a competition to see who got the most votes.
Sure. Yeah, I can't really speak to what Jeter's going to get, but I think it just speaks as a testament to, I mean, the absolute tremendous career that Rivera had, and this is coming from a lifelong Red Sox fan, and then therefore, Yankee hater, this man has brought me so much personal suffering and anguish in my own life, and even I have to admit, he's a bad man. He should be the first guy to be unanimously voted into the Hall. I don't question that decision at all.
You know, it's funny that, you know, Red Sox and Yankees fans hate each other, but I think you can attest, like, Yankees fans can attest to how much they hate, but how much they admire what David Ortiz did.
Oh, certainly.
Them. And like you said, you can admire and also hate what Mariano Rivera did. Because he was just, you guys played each other 19 times. It's, you know, you're going to see him 17 times.
Yeah, it's a complicated way to feel about another adult, to say, I hate you, but I want to shake your hand at the same time.
Exactly.
the magic of sports.
Same thing with like guys like Jason Veritek, Derek Jeter, that whole rivalry. A quick little announcement for NFL before we get into the NFC and AFC championship games. The Chiefs fired defensive coordinator Bob Sutton. I believe that was done on, what's today, Wednesday? That was done on either Monday or Tuesday. Might have even been done on Sunday night.
Here comes Rex.
But Rex Ryan is a name to watch for, they say. Bleacher Report says, or Adam Schefter reported that Rex Ryan is a name to be put in that hat.
Oh boy.
For defensive coordinator. Looks like he could be coming back, but, I mean, the way the Chiefs played defense that in that AFC championship game was not good.
Not pretty.
Not pretty at all. But I want to start with the NFC side. We have a lot to talk about with the AFC side. Let's talk about the NFC side. Did you watch the game at all?
I saw the end.
Saw the end. What was your big picture watching the end of it?
I think it's hard to say anything besides that phantom no call. I mean, that's just going to be the story of the game. I think in reality, you saw a Rams team that outplayed the Saints, but it's hard to just walk away from a game like that peacefully. You know what I mean? It's hard to just kind of close the chapter on that whole thing, given the outrageousness of that no call. And just the effect that had on the game's momentum.
I mean, you got Saints season ticket holders trying to sue the NFL and hoping that they'll replay the end of the game. And even Michael Thomas is stated Article 17, Section 3, Paragraph B or something, where the commissioner can go back and say you can redo a game or not redo a game, but pick up a game from when it left off. And Michael Thomas is, you know, telling Roger Goodell to pick up the phone so they can do that and they can replay the game. And I mean, it'll go down as you have the Tuck rule game, you have the Dez caught it game, and now you're going to have the pass interference game.
You may not be aware, but I'm hearing reports, and not personally, this is just coming from Twitter, that Goodell is in fact launching an investigation into the game with the potential of replaying it again. This is how serious this has become. If you had told me that people were going to get so mad that Roger Goodell was honestly going to sit in his office and go, oh, they might have a point. I don't think I would have believed you, but here we are. The game's being investigated. The officiating was so suspect, so abjectly horrible, we are legitimately looking into playing it again.
Because what people don't realize, too, is that, you know, they saw that what happened at the end, but there was a face mask on Jared Goff that would have led to a touchdown possibly, but it kept him to a field goal. There was another pass interference call on the Rams that wasn't called. There was a bunch of penalties in that game that just didn't get called. And now people were trying to call out that the refs lived in Los Angeles or something, and one of the refs used to play for the Rams, so sure, that's why he didn't call it or something. Sure. But it's kind of digging into the integrity of the game.
Let me ask you something, Peter. What I'm hearing right now is this is not a problem in the CFL. And of the many differences between the NFL and the CFL is the CFL is a lot more review heavy. So they do not mind having a slower game if it means getting to review and challenge no calls.
Mm-hmm.
The argument has been the NFL needs to catch up. They need to get on board with this, and they need to institute a way to challenge no calls as they do with our friends in the North. Do you think that this is the future? Do you think the NFL is willing to slow down the game in order to give a more accurate outcome? Because for the longest time, the argument was, well, we got to speed up the game. It's going to bother fans. Something tells me Saints fans wouldn't mind if the game was a little bit slower on Sunday.
Yeah, I think that is the future, because there are a lot of reports that are saying now that after this game that pass interference calls are going to be reviewable during the game. But what you have to do is coaches have two challenges per game. Either keep those two challenges or only add one other challenge, so that way they're not challenging a first play of the game pass interference call that, you know, is going to maybe go for 5 yards. Instead, sure, they can keep it for what happened on Sunday when it was a pass interference that would have cost them a first and goal.
Sure.
So I think that would be some way to help them keep the game the same speed it is while also giving the coaches that satisfaction of, okay, I can go challenge this pass interference call. But now, yeah. So now we're going to have the Tuck rule game. We're going to have the Dez caught it game. And now we're going to have the pass interference game, which that's what it's going to go down as. But frankly, the Saints just got outplayed. After the third quarter, or after the first quarter, for the last three quarters in overtime, the Saints were outscored 26-10.
You cannot lose three quarters of a game by such a margin and then turn around and blame the officials. So don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to sit here and make excuses for the Saints. I certainly agree that penalty came at a very influential point in the game. And if I was a Saints fan, I would be certainly very upset about this. And I think they're right to feel that way. And I think Michael Thomas is right to feel frustrated about it. But yeah, Peter, I think you're absolutely right. If you're going to lose three out of four quarters, it's really hard to point at the officiating, even on a outrageous non-call like that one.
Exactly. And it wasn't like the Saints were marching down the field whenever they wanted to. It was a lot of three-play drives, four-play drives, stuff like that.
Sure. I think, honestly, man, if that call gets made, I'm still not sure the Saints go on to...
Well, here's another thing, though, is you got a minute, what? It was a minute 40, 5, minute 40, something like that. Why not run the ball? Get the clock down. You're going to waste a timeout from the Rams, who only had one at that point. You're going to make it go down to 30, 35, even 40 seconds of play time. We don't know if that's going to be enough for Goff to do anything. And you would have had your touchdown or your field goal. So why not try to have a more... Because it was an obvious run situation. You have first and 10 at the 15. Run three plays. If you get a first down, game over. If you don't, it's going to run the clock down to 40 seconds. Kick your field goal, play defense for 40 seconds instead of having to play defense for almost a minute and a half. And that's just something that I think the Saints outsmarted themselves. I think they were trying to show, especially in the first, 10 weeks of the season where they only had that one loss, they were the smartest offense in the league. Then as soon as that Dallas game happened where they lost 13-10, they were 4-2 for the rest of the year. Drew Brees didn't look like anything. Even Michael Thomas yesterday had 211 receiving yards. In the first time they played, had 36 this game. So it was, I think it was just a tale of two different teams, really.
Yeah, man. You know, I think outsmarting yourself is a good word for it. And sometimes you just lose. And it sounds like the Saints really took that Dallas loss to heart, and it made them change the way that they play, or at least it made them overthink it. And that's enough to give you an outcome like that.
Yeah, that offense just wasn't looking anything like it was the first couple of weeks, where it was scoring basically 40 points a game, especially even against the Eagles where they won 41-7. It was two completely different offenses. Just one of those games where you're just scratching your head like, you know, why doesn't this happen, or why didn't you guys do this? But instead, it's going to be known as a pass interference game. And to your point where they're trying to replay the game, when would they do that?
I was going to say, you better hurry up and figure that out. Do we cancel the Pro Bowl? Like, where is this held? I don't think it's so easy as going out and just lining them up and having them do it again.
Yeah, and you got to also think that there's a lot of, like, the logistics of it. Like, how do you get the Rams, who are probably already in L.A. preparing for the Super Bowl, how do you get them back? And then if they win, now they only have 6 days to do. Like, how are you going to do this?
That's exactly right. I do just want to point out, there's absolutely no chance that this happens. I think this is probably just Goodell trying to, maybe due diligence is not the word, trying to appease the Saints fan base a little bit and say, listen, I'm on your side, some officiating was bad. Yeah, there's no chance an NFL game gets replayed in 2019.
Yeah, no.
Two weeks before the Super Bowl.
Yeah, not an NFC championship game that, like, you still had a chance to win it in overtime, too. But Drew Brees threw a pick.
Yeah, not going
to
happen.
So it's really not the fault of that, because you had a chance to drive down the field. If you get a touchdown, you win the game. But you threw an interception at the 50-yard line. They only had to go 15 yards for a field goal. It's one of those things. A lot of people also realize that Todd Gurley didn't have a lot to say in that game. He only had 10 yards and only carried the ball 4 times. So this begs the question, is he injured, or was he nursing something possibly wrong with him? Like, is he going to be healthy for the Super Bowl?
If Todd Gurley is not healthy for the Super Bowl, things bode very, very well for New England.
Because granted, he did have a touchdown run, but it was only a 6-yard touchdown run.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that's a great point, Peter. I honestly don't know anything about that. I imagine in a situation like that, if you have a guy that's hurt, I mean, you can't very well rest him for the Super Bowl in the NFC Championship game, because you're not getting to the Super Bowl if he doesn't play his best, which evidently I'm wrong. Credit to CJ Anderson. Yeah, honestly, I'm not sure about that, Peter. I can't imagine you trying to rest a guy thinking that you are going to just get by a team like the Saints and move on to the Super Bowl. So I almost have to think that that's the problem. And he might be the kind of guy where, even if he's not 100%, even if he's not 70%, having him out there is enough of a mental factor for that Saints defense to make them worried about him the whole game.
Yeah, exactly. And even if he's one of those guys where he can't go the full game, he could still be that second down back if you're in the 5-yard line, or on the 5-yard line of the red zone trying to get that touchdown.
Exactly.
So he could still be a little bit of a factor. But, you know, having the Saints being able to take away Todd Gurley and the Rams taking away Michael Thomas, it was pretty much what I said, that I thought these two guys needed to be taken away from the game for either the Saints or the Rams to have a chance to win. And obviously that happened, and it went into overtime. So I cut, you know, a little bit of a pat on the back to myself, because I was 1-for-2 in predictions. I predicted the Patriots to win. I was dead wrong with the score. And then I predicted the Saints to win 30-24. Little off on that prediction.
Yeah, just about. But
so now the Rams go on to the Super Bowl. First time they've been in the Super Bowl since Super Bowl 36 in 2002, when they lost to their now Super Bowl opponents, New England Patriots, when their dynasty started 18 years ago in Super Bowl 36, Tom Brady's first Super Bowl win. So now he's going to go for
many.
Now he's going for Super Bowl number 6. Got to win one for the thumb. So now going over to the AFC side. Patriots beat the Jets in another epic overtime finish. 37-31, sending Tom Brady and the Patriots to their record 9th Super Bowl in 18 years. 38 combined points in just the fourth quarter, which led to the Chiefs tying the game up at 31 with 11 seconds left. I know you watched this game, because we talked about it before the show. Initial thoughts, reactions, fears going into the Super Bowl. What you got?
I think that there are a lot of reasons why people hate the New England Patriots. And, as a precursor, I am a Patriots fan. I grew up in New England. I'm not a bandwagoner. Being from the great state of New Hampshire, we do not have a lot to be excited about. We get the primaries once every 4 years. And besides that, we get 8 hours of daylight and we watch the Patriots. So please do not mislabel me as a bandwagoner. That being said, I'm going to try to keep my personal biases out of it. But I think the reason that the people of this great country hate the Patriots so much are for things like this. Because they just keep defying the narrative. And by that, I don't even mean the underdog thing. You know, I don't think the Patriots overcame all odds to win this game. They're still the Patriots. Tom Brady is still Tom Brady. And that's it, period. But as far as the narrative goes, the way that this was being set up is, here we go. Here comes the future. Patrick Mahomes, this young 23-year-old upstart. I watched highlights of him throwing that no-look and the sidearm thing. I probably saw that sidearm pass 1,000 times. This guy is it. The young phenom. It's David and Goliath. He's going to take down the old legend. The passing of the torch. Oh, the passing of the torch. Peter, if I had a nickel, man, for every time I had to hear about the passing of the stupid torch in the weeks ahead, I don't think I could buy anything valuable, and I still would have a lot of nickels. It is just absurd, and I think people are really ready for that. And so the reason that this is so painful is, yet again, the torch is not passed. Tom Brady is old enough to be Patrick Mahomes' father, and here we go again. America's worst nightmare has come to fruition. That being said, for a young guy like that to go out there and put fear into the hearts of Patriots fans around the country, you know, of course it goes without being said, Patrick Mahomes is a bad man, and he has a bright future around of him, and I sincerely hope that the Chiefs organization doesn't squander it, and that he can get the help he needs, and he can have the right situation to go out there and hopefully get himself a Super Bowl someday.
Yeah, because he's going to be the MVP this year. He will win NFL MVP, 50 touchdowns, 5,000 yards. I mean, had, 10, 11 interceptions?
Certainly.
But, I mean, still, the body of work, there you go, is just phenomenal. He had a great first starting season. I consider this his, you know, quote-unquote rookie season because he only had one start last year. But to do what he was able to do as starting his first full season is something amazing.
Let me ask you this, Peter. I am hearing some people suggest, and this really has come from the mouth of ESPN personality Max Kellerman, that Tom Brady was outrageously lucky to win this game. Do you think that there was a luck component involved? Did the Patriots simply get away with one here?
No, because at the end of the day, even just speaking about overtime, they had 3 third-and-10s, and Tom Brady was able to find the open receiver, which he's usually able to do. You had 3 opportunities to get Tom Brady off the field. One would have just been a field goal. You go down, score touchdowns, game's over. But no, he was able to pick apart the defense like he's done for the last 18 years. And if you want to say there's luck, whatever. He got a lucky break. He was able to win the coin toss, whatever. And everybody's going up in arms about how they need to change the overtime rules now. And I don't think that should happen. Because overtime, the way it is if your defense can't make a stop, why should we reward the offense to try to go out there and play?
I agree.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You know, I don't think NFL fans really give equal weight to the importance of both halves of the team. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Like, in the mind of an NFL fan, the offense is really the real team. That's what you're coming to watch. And the defense, you know, they're there ultimately to support the offense. And don't get me wrong. I'm not somebody that's so by the book about sports that I can't see the point. Of course you want to go see your offense on the field. That's more fun. If you are trying to tell me that you have more fun watching your team on defense than offense, you are either lying or a Ravens fan. Like, that's just not the case. I don't understand that. I would like to see the rule changed, but for the time being, I think you're just kind of stuck with it. And I don't see that change being made anytime soon.
Because I don't think that's a big problem in overtime. Because first of all, you know, somebody on Twitter said, you know, Aaron Rodgers wasn't able to get the ball in 2015. Matt Ryan in 2016 Super Bowl wasn't able to get the ball back. And Patrick Mahomes wasn't able to get the ball back on Sunday. And it made me think about this. I don't know the whole Aaron Rodgers game. I don't remember what he's talking about. But I do know the Patrick Mahomes, obviously, and the Matt Ryan game he's talking about. Matt Ryan and the Falcons had a 25-3 lead for three quarters, and they couldn't hold it for basically one quarter, a quarter and a half.
Sure.
So why should we reward you with a chance to win the game when you had 15 minutes to win the game and you squandered a 25-point lead?
That's exactly right, Dan.
So if your defense can't hold a 25-point lead and your offense isn't smart enough to hold a 25-point lead, you probably shouldn't get the ball back because you put that on yourself. And the same thing with Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs. The Chiefs' defense had three opportunities to get off the field. They were all third and tens. Tried to run it twice, did nothing. Third and ten, found Gronk, found Edelman. And I think they found Edelman again. So why should we give you the opportunity if your defense couldn't help you out, when your defense said, you know what, we're not going to care about this possession, we'll let you score the touchdown? Why should we let the offense be rewarded with trying to score and you know, tie the game up?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right.
If the defense is just going to go back out there and give up another touchdown.
It's a team sport, and we tend to think of these matchups in terms of quarterback versus quarterback. I mean, I heard nothing but Brady and Mahomes the whole week, but the reality of the situation is that the Chiefs' defense is every bit the Kansas City Chiefs that Patrick Mahomes is. That does not make any sense to me. Granted, I agree with the people that say the entertainment value isn't there. It's more exciting if both quarterbacks get a chance to have the ball. But in reality, there is nothing inherently unfair about the NFL overtime. It's just disheartening if you were on the wrong side of it.
Exactly. And the same thing goes for the Saints game. The Saints had an opportunity to win. They picked the ball off. Rams were able to go down and score. So,
yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that, man. Now, looking ahead, based on what I saw from the Patriots is, you know, typical Patriots, they're going to go ahead and do something you don't expect. It's almost laughable how important this run game is to that team. Like, if you have Rob Gronkowski and Julian Edelman lining up alongside Tom Brady, you should think to yourself, boy, it's probably going to be the pass attack. But with these guys, I really think the key to success against the Rams, and I think it certainly was in crucial moments in the Kansas City game, is going to be James White and Sony Michel. And let me tell you something, man. The Boston sports media, they are just absolutely nauseating. These guys are awful. Radio, TV, it doesn't matter. There is this horrible air of negativity that hangs over every single team in the city, and the Patriots are no different. I saw a segment on Boston Sports Tonight. This is a TV show that back up in New England that, you know, mainly focuses on the Patriots this time of year, and they had a whole segment called Phony Michel, question mark, questioning the legitimacy of Sony Michel as an option.
Yet he had 113 yards and two touchdowns.
After he had just had three touchdowns in a game against the Chargers, and then he goes out there and does that to the Chiefs. I really don't know what to tell you, man. It's just absurd. Anybody that is devaluing the run game as part of this Patriots offense is nuts, and they just haven't watched any games.
And it's kind of weird to see how it's kind of flipped the last couple of years, because if you remember when they had Gronk, Edelman, Amendola, you know, guys like that, it was a pass-heavy attack, run the ball when you had the lead to kill the clock. Now it's, all right, we're going to start off with the run. You saw it in the first drive of the game. They were run-heavy, especially in overtime. They were trying to run the ball, but then they had to go to their pass attack. You know, it's kind of flipped the last couple of years. Now you have Sony Michel, James White, who I think are the two best running back tandem in the league. Because you got Sony Michel, who can run for 113 yards, and you got James White, who against the Chargers had 97 yards on 15 catches.
Sure.
So one of those two guys that also James White can run the ball when he needs to. He can give you 6-7 yards when he needs to. And then you have guys like Rex Burkhead, James Devlin, who in the red zone costed me major fantasy points this year because I had Sony Michel or James White playing, and Ryan Devlin just, you know, takes the ball and gets a touchdown, so it cost me 6 points. You know, now that they're run, I don't understand why you're doubting the legitimacy of Sony Michel when he did this in the regular season too, and now he's doing it on the biggest stage in the postseason. So
I don't know what to tell you.
That's weird to me because, like I said, Michel had 113 yards, two touchdowns. And this is a guy that when he got drafted, I was like, you know, do we really need to use a first round pick on him? And What is he gonna play like? He's coming off of a knee injury. You know, Georgia, he did good, but you know, he got injured. So what's gonna happen? I'm glad they picked him because Deion Lewis left. He was more like a James White. So now we have an actual runner of the football that can get you 7, 8, 9 yards, which he did in the game last week. And now you have James White in the backfield who can go out wide, catch a couple of screen passes, which he also did in Kansas City on Sunday. So, I mean, but just looking at the first play, at the first drive too, 15 plays, 80 yards, 8 minutes and 5 seconds. The same thing they did against the Chargers, they did against the Chiefs. And look what happened. Same outcome.
I think if you open up a game and you let the Patriots march down the field like that, it's going to be a long night for you. Because despite the star power and the history that that team has, you know, that's not a Hail Mary to win the game team. That's just a dink and dunk. We're going to get our yards here and there. We're going to convert on big third downs, and we're just going to do things the right way. And that's how they end up winning games. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, I said last week, too, I said if this was going to be a slow, methodical running game, okay, yeah, the Patriots are going to win because I think they have the better running back combination than the Chiefs have now, because especially because of the Kareem Hunt incident. So, and obviously we saw that. Now, in the second half, the game started to speed up a little bit. Wide receivers had to be used a lot more than running backs, but still able to get the running backs involved. But I thought Brady had another excellent game. I know it's going to sound like we're, you know, throwing him a big party again. But, you know, in overtime, too, especially with those three third downs, 348 yards, a touchdown, did throw two interceptions, especially one in the red zone. But I thought he played, you know, he's, you know, everybody's saying he's quote unquote falling off a cliff. You know, I made reference to that last week, and I said, you know, his falling off a cliff was better than Peyton Manning's 2008 MVP season. Peyton Manning, just to let you know, I don't know if you were listening to the show, Peyton Manning in 2008 won the MVP with 25 touchdowns, 10 interceptions, 4,002 yards. Tom Brady's quote-unquote falling off a cliff season, 29 touchdowns, 11 interceptions, 4,300 yards. With a better rating than Peyton Manning had in 2008.
This is why America hates this guy. America, I don't blame you. If I didn't love him, I would probably hate him too. Yeah, that's just absurd, man. That's just absurd.
So some other notable stuff from the game was that Tyreek Hill and Travis Kelce were nowhere to be found. Tyreek Hill had one reception for 42 yards. Travis Kelce had three catches for 23 yards.
He did have that one touchdown.
He did have the one touchdown, but it's, you know, Bill Belichick is able to usually does a good job of taking away a team's best player. But in this case where he took away two of the team's better players, I mean, that has to go on him as having a good defensive game plan. We're going to do this. We're going to take away him because Tyreek Hill only had three targets, too, and only caught one of those passes. So to be able to not have Tyreek Hill burn the Patriots defense like he did in week 6 when they first played him is a testament to what kind of defense Bill Belichick can run. So, I mean, that goes to show you that Bill Belichick knows a little bit about defense.
Yeah, he knows a thing or two. He's a pretty smart guy. Safe to say at this point. Yeah, man, I think really that's just the Patriots' MO, is they're going to take what you do best off the table, and then they're going to make you come through, and if you're going to beat them, you're going to have to beat them with your B guys or your B playbook. And if it works for you, congratulations. But it's been 18 years, and for the most part, it doesn't usually go well.
This is a couple of cool stats that I found on the internet, everywhere else. Going into the Super Bowl, Brady and Goff share the largest age gap, 17 years, 72 days, of any starting quarterback matchup in Super Bowl history. Belichick and McVay have the largest age gap for coaches, 33 years, 283 days. Sean McVay doesn't turn 33 years old till Thursday. That's of any head coach in Super Bowl matchup. And Tom Brady has 9 Super Bowl appearances. He has the most in any franchise, most Super Bowl appearances than any franchise other than the Patriots, who have 11. So, and of course, Brady and Goff having the largest age gap and Belichick and McVay, if you add Brady and Belichick's age gap, that's the largest in history to McVay and Goff, which I think is like 52, 53 years, something like that, something incredible like
that. It's unreal. It's unreal, man. And get ready to hear that as the major talking point from the national media as CBS goes ahead and prepares to really create a storyline out of this. And they should. It doesn't bother me. But just get ready to hear time and time again about this age gap and the young generation and the old generation. And have no doubt the Patriots, once again, will be looking to disrupt the narrative as they do.
And Tony Romo, CBS, his broadcasting was amazing.
Yes, I've heard a lot of Romo believers. You're a big Romo guy?
I'm a big Romo guy now. A
lot of Romo guys out there. I mean, I like Tony Romo, man. I saw somebody that tweeted, Tony Romo is like your friend in the group chat that has the stream of the game that's 15 seconds ahead of yours. It's absolutely unbelievable the way that he can just call things. I think my favorite thing about Romo the broadcaster is how he's genuinely so excited. There was 2 minutes left on the clock, and he said, 2 minutes left to go to the Super Bowl. Can you believe it? He was thrilled. Tony Romo's having the time of his life because now he gets to enjoy football, and nobody's going to hit him or call him overrated. He's safe now.
And I think that he's going to do an excellent job for the Super Bowl since CBS does have the
absolutely.
The game this year.
Absolutely. The booth is a great place for Tony Romo, and I cannot respect him enough. He's doing a great job.
Yeah, there was another thing, too, on Twitter. Like, everybody was just praising Tony Romo. And Bryce Harper is like, just called Tony Romo to ask him where I'm playing next year. And Tony Romo retweets, he's like, just found out you're playing for the Texas Rangers next year. So
Tony knows.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. A couple more stats, because I want to ask you a little bit about some basketball here. ESPN released their power index before the championship games for chances to win the Super Bowl. Kansas City had the most with 34%. New Orleans Saints had the second most with 33%. Next was the Los Angeles Rams with 18%, and the Patriots had 15% to win the Super Bowl. So the two lowest teams are going to play for the Super Bowl. So that just tells you how much ESPN knows and how much I dislike ESPN now.
Wow. Wow, so, shots fired. Yeah. You know, hindsight's 2020, man, and it's easy to sit here and say, well, you should have known better, this, that, and the third. I will say this, to ESPN's credit and all of the pundits that did not pick the Patriots, it sounds silly and it sounds wrong to not pick the Patriots, but the fact of the matter is you've got a quarterback that's getting ready to apply for AARP benefits. You've got what's left of Rob Gronkowski. You've got old, unathletic receivers. It makes sense on paper to not pick them. I mean, in reality, of course, it does not. But at the end of the day, they're the Patriots is not a statistic. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
So was it the right pick? No. I think it's outrageous to say that Brady's falling off a cliff and that he got lucky to win that game and, you know, all those outlandish things. But as far as not picking them, I don't blame them.
Exactly. We did turn over. There was one guy that turned to the quote-unquote dark side, Shannon Sharp. I don't know if you watch Undisputed. Great show with him and Skip Bayless.
Oh, terrific.
But he said that he will no longer say that Aaron Rodgers is better than Tom Brady after watching what happened on Sunday.
Wow.
Because he was a big believer that Aaron Rodgers was better than Tom Brady. And even said last week that he's like, you know, Tom Brady's a cool guy and I'm sure he's the best dude, but I'm just tired of all this winning. Which is what a lot of Americans think.
Essentially.
But he got turned over to the quote-unquote dark side. So that was pretty cool to watch. And he's one of those guys that now that is like, all right, I'm not picking against Tom Brady anymore. But some more statistics before we go, or some more facts for the game before we go into some basketball. The Patriots-Rams over-under for the Super Bowl is 58, which would be the largest in Super Bowl history.
Jeez.
If it stayed that way. So they're expecting both of these teams to come out and just absolutely put on a show, just like last year's Super Bowl.
Yeah.
Absolute offensive show. So that would be interesting to see.
The game plan is outscore the other guy.
Exactly.
It sounds outlandish, but yeah, I think that 58 you said sounds like a right number.
We haven't really talked a lot of basketball. I'll have Julian on the show on Friday, hopefully. He'll talk a little bit of basketball as well with me, as we always do. But now that I have our NBA insider, NBA expert, that's the word I was
expert,
looking for.
That was it, yes. Certified. So, certified expert.
NBA expert. What does your, because we're about to go into the All-Star break for the NBA. What is your take so far for the first half? What has been your take?
I'll tell you, man, this is really that special dry time of year. Pre-All-Star break is when you're just sitting here watching some good old January basketball when you know nothing really matters, but it's still fun to tune in, and you start getting these little storylines that develop. You know, is Draymond Green washed now? Is Memphis going to move Marc Gasol and Mike Conley? These sorts of things. And if you look at yourself and you're really pondering the fate of the Memphis Grizzlies, you can safely say it is a dry part of the season. You know, as far as big picture implications, man, I hate to say it, I think this is Golden State's year yet again. I don't know what to tell you. If you look at the league, there's not anybody that's standing out to me that makes me say, oh, yeah, I would take them in a 7-game series over the Golden State Warriors. And I wish I could sit here and give you my elaborate conspiracy theory reasons why this is it for the Toronto Raptors. This is why they're going to do it. But the fact of the matter is nobody's come close. And the team that I thought had the greatest chance to do it was in the West, which was Houston last year. And if you will recall, they got very, very close. But the way that they've played this year, even with Harden being on an absolute historical tear. I mean, the things that this man have been doing, it's just insane what James Harden is capable of. But one man cannot dethrone an entire team like that. Now, say Chris Paul comes back, say he looks better than he has. I like Houston a lot more, and we'll see what happens. But for the time being, I don't think anybody in the East is going to do it, and I don't see anybody in the West getting past
especially him. Now with DeMarcus Cousins coming back. He doesn't have to play a big role, but he's going to play some type of role.
That's exactly right.
So now from one superstar to the next, Kemba Walker. So I just got this report on Bleacher Report that says Kemba Walker trade unlikely, and it says several teams, including the Mavs, have tried to trade for Kemba Walker, which I think the Mavs getting Kemba Walker would actually kind of be pretty interesting because it would have Kemba Walker and Luka Doncic, who has been playing really good.
Oh my goodness!
This year in the backcourt,
he is just a freak, man. Let me tell you something. Luka Doncic is, you know, we've seen rookies come into the league and play very well before. He's scoring very naturally. We've seen that plenty of times. You know, he's a great distributor. He's a surprising rebounder for his position. All those things are wonderful, but the biggest thing when I see Luka and the way that he plays is his confidence. He looks like a guy that's been in the league for years. I mean, he's out here ripping his jersey like Hulk Hogan and mouthing off to refs and talking trash to people. You have to have a lot of nerve to come over from Croatia and start talking trash to James Harden and LeBron James. So if I'm a Mavericks fan, I'm pretty excited. I think the future is very bright.
And onto the Bobcats side, though, you have to want Kemba Walker to either move so you can see him be successful, or you need another star on that team. Bradley Beal or somebody? I don't know.
I'll tell you.
You need somebody to help Kemba Walker out.
I have nothing but respect for Kemba Walker. Kemba Walker is the guard equivalent of Anthony Davis in terms of being absurdly talented and forever stranded on this subpar team. Kemba, if you're listening, please, there are people that care about you. I need you to get out of Charlotte, my man. Anywhere else. Man, go play in China. Play in the rec league. I've got an intramural team. You can play for us. But please, Charlotte is not the way. Until Michael Jordan or whoever is running the show over there gets you some help, this is not going to work. I really tip my hat to the guy for being loyal. And like a situation with a guy like Damian Lillard, right? A supremely talented guard in a team that can't get it done. At least they're trying to put things around him, and they look promising. Every year, Charlotte just falls flat. Yeah, he's got to get out, man. And I think the Mavs would be a great fit. That's not something I'd considered, but when you think about a team that hasn't really had a terrific point guard situation since, shoot, man.
Really, like, you know, Jason Kidd
exactly,
or
yeah.
Steve Nash early in the 90s.
What was left of Jason Kidd, that probably is the best they've had in a long, long time.
Wow, I just lost my train of thought. Oh, the Los Angeles Lakers.
Yes.
We're in the third seed. Now they're the ninth seed without LeBron. It's been about 30 days, almost as much as the government's been shut down.
We're in the Lakers shutdown right now.
That would explain it.
Furloughing winning games.
So now they're only a half a game out of the eighth seed. LeBron comes back. Where do you see them finishing up? Because obviously LeBron is going to make them better than what they are.
Yeah. You know, a team like the Lakers, give me the number six seed. I have a hard time believing that they're going to catch up to Golden State, Denver, OKC, Portland, Houston, and then, I mean, maybe they even slide to seven. The Clippers have looked really good since going on a mysterious slide. I'm still waiting for the Jazz to turn it on, and as long as Pop is in charge of the Spurs, I'm not going to count them out either. So I think they make the playoffs. I think that 5-6-7 range is probably their wheelhouse. And to be honest with you, Peter, I don't think they're that worried about it. I don't think this year ever really meant anything to them. I think this was, hey, LeBron, let's get you here. Let's make a few things happen with contracts. Let's make some money. Let's put some butts in seats, and we'll worry about getting you some help later on during what's going to be a wild 2019 free agency summer.
So now, usually when people call to apologize, they they say they're sorry. They for their actions, which is exactly what Kyrie Irving did.
He did
to LeBron James.
He did,
but in my mind, I think it was a little bit of a dig at his young budding stars. I think he's trying to tell him, hey, I apologize for being a good leader. I'm your leader now. You should be apologizing to me the way we've been playing.
Sure.
Like, I'm your leader now. Treat me as such.
Yes. I think it's easy to see that. So, at first, I want to address the apology thing. I went back and forth on this, but I think at the end of the day, it is a very strong and mature and difficult thing to do to go ahead and call somebody and apologize to them. And I saw somebody point this out. It really proves that Kyrie did learn from LeBron, because not only did he call and apologize, he then immediately told the national media, which is, I'm sure, exactly what LeBron would do. That's just what he likes to do. As far as the chemistry on that Celtics team and Kyrie Irving's role in all of that, I don't know if I can take my green glasses off. Lifelong Celtics fan. I'm a big enthusiast. This season has been trying, to say the least. Not what I had hoped it would be. I don't think that the Celtics are worried about Kyrie Irving's leadership, and I don't think he's a problem in that locker room. Because you go ahead, you look at the apology, you look at all those things, and then a few days later, they had that big Toronto game. They had lost three straight. They had lost to the Heat. They had lost to the Nets. And I think the Magic previous to that. So they lost three very winnable games, three games they had no business losing. They come back into Boston. The media is a flutter. Oh, we're going to trade Terry Rozier. Oh, Jaylen Brown hates Kyrie. Oh, Kyrie's a bad leader. Oh, he's going to go to New York. Oh, it's the end of the world. The Celtics come out. They have a terrific win against a top-ranked, you know, rightfully so, very scary Toronto Raptors team. And then what does Kyrie do? He goes right to the media right away, says all the right things. You know what? My teammates are right. I need to take it easy on the finger pointing. We all have some work to do. We're going to figure this out together. I think part of the learning curve of leading a team is not just the part where you lead it, but you have to know what it looks like from the outside. So for him to go and say that he called LeBron and apologized, having never led a team in this capacity, I don't think that he suspected it was going to go ahead and make their whole organization look bad. I don't think he saw that coming. Now I think he realizes. So I don't think there's anything to be worried about here. I don't think it was a shot at his younger teammates. I think that was just him taking a look into his past and saying, I didn't understand your perspective before, but I understand it now. I'm not worried. And that's what I tell myself before I fall asleep at night, so I can feel better about the Celtics, because sometimes I worry about the, I worry about them, excuse me.
They're on a four-game win streak. In fact, all of the top six seeds are on a four-game, or on at least a win streak of some sort. One win is not really a win streak, but, you know, four games is.
Sure.
What's surprising is, I didn't see this until I was looking at the win streaks, the Brooklyn Nets are the sixth seed right now.
The Brooklyn Nets, baby. 8-2 in the last 10.
They are 25-23.
Four it must game be
that,
win streak?
That Dinwiddie magic or something. I don't know. But
listen, man, I have been a Nets truther for the last couple of years. And it started as a Celtics fan. I was paying attention to them and rooting for them to lose because we had their pick. And in doing so, I discovered something I did not expect to see. This is, get ready for this. I got some conspiracy theory stuff coming your way.
All right.
The Nets are building the next Golden State. Not in terms of dominance. I'm not saying Spencer Dinwiddie, Steph Curry, but in terms of the way that they're constructing that team, in terms of we're going to go from the ground up, we're going to bring our guys, we don't care what anyone says, we're going to make it work, we're going to get these long, rangy, switch everything, defend all five positions, shoot the three, go for layups, we're going to play an analytics-based game. They're like the Publix brand Nets. like the Publix brand Warriors is what they are. And I think we are just now starting to see the fruits of that. You know, do I think they are going to get far in the postseason? No, I do not. But I'm going to be honest with you. If I'm the Pacers, do I want a 7-game series with the Nets? No, I do not think I do. In fact, I think that whole upper class of the NBA is thinking to themselves, geez, yeah, I really don't want to run into these guys. So I don't want to sound prideful here, Peter, but this has been very validating. I've been on board with the Nets very quietly for the last couple of seasons, and I think they're really pulling it together now.
You can't knock them for what they're doing.
No, and the thing that's so scary is that they're in New York. So it's one thing when you see a team like Indiana pull it together, right? Really no stars. They're just playing good team basketball, and they're making it happen. But what's scary about a team doing that in Brooklyn, New York, is as long as you are in a big market like that, you are always going to have free agent names attached to
it. Yep.
And if I am Kawhi Leonard, right,
ooh,
I'm freezing my butt off in Toronto. I'm getting tired of eating poutine. I'm tired of maple syrup. All right, I want a break. I want out of the six. I don't want the Drake curse over me. I'm thinking to myself,
Brooklyn.
Brooklyn. That's a team that could use a star. That's a big, fun market. Yeah, I don't know, man. Don't sleep on the Nets.
Wow.
I don't want to run into them in the postseason.
Wow. Okay, well, we have to go. Especially after that. That's interesting.
Leave it on a hot take.
Leave it on a hot take. Some more news, though, before we end this show. Greg Schiano is likely to join New England as the defensive. Larry Fitzgerald will be back for 2019.
Yes.
His 16th year. He is 23 receptions away from catching Tony Gonzalez for second most all time.
Never retire, Larry.
Yeah, Ichiro, he's a future Hall of Famer for sure.
Oh, my goodness.
Another future Hall of Famer, Ichiro Suzuki. He will re-sign with the Mariners on a minor league contract. The 45-year-old is doing this so that he can play in the opening series in Japan. After that, he'll likely retire.
Oh, that's nice. Guy just likes to play.
But good. It was a good showmanship for the Mariners to sign him back up.
That's classic.
And then, that's actually it. Rays' Wander Franco, he's a shortstop. He's just 17. He was just named the top 10 shortstop prospects. So that is all from us. As always, I'm your host, Peter Jaffee. We will be back on Friday. Oh, and Sean McKinney is next to me, our NBA insider / analyst / expert /
Nets
whatever.
Nets enthusiast
now. We'll be back on Friday. Hopefully Julian will be back to we'll just kind of showcase some more of the NBA because I'm not showcasing the Pro Bowl. That's terrible. For all of you that love the Pro Bowl, I feel sorry for you. We'll be back on Friday to discuss some more Super Bowl, some more baseball, hopefully. Maybe some offseason news will be on, and also some more basketball. So, Sean, anything to say to the nice people?
Have a great afternoon, and we'll see you in the postseason, Nets.
As always, I am your host, Peter Defeed, Sean McKinney, joining me. This has been Sports Access. Hoping you have a great rest of your Wednesday, and we will see you on Friday.